Cold Mountain came out about 20 years ago, 19 years ago. I read it when it first came out, and now it's inspired a lot of other things, a movie, an opera, and this year's one book. Why do you think that there have been so many adaptations? What is it that captured people's imaginations?
You know, I'm probably the last person to ask that of. I don't know. There is an element of yearning in the book, an element of trying to understand how to create a life that is sustainable despite the damage of living, that was more interesting to me than details of the Civil War and what general said this or did that. I was more interested in the effect of devastating moments in history on individual people. And so I guess there's an element of that it makes it kind of always applicable to whatever war is going on at our particular moment in life. On the other hand, if you knew what makes a book last, you might be able to do it over and over. Or,
you know, you read that it's going to be a book about the Civil War, but then it isn't really. It's a book filled with all kinds of other things, filled with the yearning that you talked about and filled with this incredible odyssey. And, you know, maybe that was, it was such a different approach to a topic that so many people felt that they knew something about.
Well, you know, and because people do get so fascinated with those big personalities on both sides of that war, and the minutiae of troop movements and which regiment did this at Gettysburg and those kinds of things that really don't engage me. But I'd heard the story about this ancestor who had been involved in many of those really crucial points in the war and then walked home and was killed by the home guard after he had deserted. And I thought, well, that's a story I think I know how to tell, is that walk home and that attempt to get your life back, to find out whether you've been damaged beyond repair or whether you might be repairable. You know, when I realized it was not the Iliad, it was the Odyssey, then I could move forward on that book.
And did you kind of use the Odyssey as you know, a template in your mind for how things might progress or what sort of things needed to happen?
Yeah, I read the Odyssey. There was always a copy of it on the desk all the way through writing the book. But mainly what I used it for, there are a number of places in the Odyssey where Odysseus stops and sort of prays. And I looked at those because that indicated what he was afraid of, what he was hoping for, those kinds of things. So I had all those marked in the book. And sometimes when I would get stuck, I'd go back and read one or two of those to just help. Help is not exactly get an idea from it, but to get a feeling from it that would help me move forward.
Philadelphia is making a big deal about Bartram's travels, as you might imagine. We are. And you know, you did use it in the book. What was it in particular why did you have Inman refer to it as kind of a tonic, a soothing kind of thing?
Yeah, he carries a copy of Bartram's travels. It's missing the covers, so it's rolled up like a religious text, a scroll, and he carries it with him and he reads these beautiful, sometimes extremely convoluted descriptions of nature. The part of the Southern Appalachians where I grew up is where Bartram stayed a while, made an Indian village called Cowie, a kind of base of his. So he knew that territory well and wrote about it. And so I grew up with Bartram as a local figure, in a sense. So I wanted to, and the Cherokees called him Flower Gatherer. So I liked that kind of hippie flower in his hair kind of image as a contrast to the horrors of war that Inman was escaping.
I wanted to ask you about fiddle music. I went through this book because I was really trying to find some good references to fiddle music. I find a ton of them. But what I found interesting here, the way you used, and I didn't really even know how to say this character's name, but it's...
Stavrod.
Stavrod?
Yeah.
What is it about his playing that's different from fiddle music that you may have heard all around you?
Well, I used a few models for his playing. One of them was a man named Gaither Carleton, who was Doc Watson's father-in-law. And there are some recordings of him, and it's really ragged, really rhythmic and driving. It's not bluegrass fiddling. It's that old-time Southern Appalachian fiddling that relates as much to Ireland and Scotland as what came after. And he had this raw, powerful, primitive voice. And I listened to him a lot when I was writing Stavrod. I wanted it to be that kind of repetitious music that's almost hypnotic, that kind of weirdly spiritual music that he's discovered is worth pouring his life into.
It's kind of a salvation for him in a way. I mean, it sounds like it's a positive thing that he has done for a life that's kind of been a bit wasted.
Yeah, he's been pretty worthless up to that point, and tries to convince Ruby, and it takes some work to convince her that he's changed, and it's music that's changed him.
On page 296, Stavrod is playing, and Ada and Ruby are listening. And I don't know how you feel about this, but would you be willing to read a little bit of it?
Okay. Give it a go. Ada and Ruby watched amazed as Stavrod spun out the music. He had apparently, at least for this forlorn piece, forsaken the short, choppy bow strokes of all known fiddlers and was longbowing notes of great sweetness and stridency. It was music the like of which Ruby had never heard, nor, for that matter, had Ada. His playing was as easy as a man drawing breath, yet with utter conviction in its centrality to a life worth claiming. To Ada, though, it seemed akin to a miracle that Stavrod, of all people, should offer himself up as proof positive that no matter what a waste one has made of one's life, it is ever possible to find some path to redemption, however partial.
How long did it take you to write this?
The whole book?
Yeah.
Something like maybe 8 years.
Now when you write, because you've written two books after this, is the process any easier, or do you just feel more confident?
It's a little easier in the sense that I know the process that works for me, and I have accepted that it's a messy and inefficient process, that I don't write, I don't start on page one and write to the end. It's a mess of bits and scenes and snippets of conversation for a long time. And it looks like I've told editors who ask to see something, I've said, if I show it to you now, it will scare you to death because it looks like it will never be a book. So just give me another year, and maybe by then I'll have a little bit you can read. So it's, I would love to have a different process, but this is the one I'm stuck with.
Is it excruciating for you, or do you just have faith that I will put these things down and I will eventually make sense of them?
Yeah. There's I get all those bits and they're floating around, and I think of it like, in the formation of the solar system, there was just this mass of junk out there, and then it formed an accretion disk, and that disk began coming together. And so I just think I've just got to let this accrete and let gravity do its work, and one day it'll find some shape, and not get frustrated that's the process, because I've tried doing it other ways and it just doesn't work for me.
The opera, you gave that project a green light. And also a movie. What is it? Is there a litmus test, or how do you decide whether something, merits an adaptation or another use of your book?
Well, I mean, people ask me a lot about the role that a writer has in controlling an adaptation. And the phrase that often gets used is, did you have a say, or did you have the final say? And I, my attitude is always, the place that I have a say is deciding whether to let it happen to begin with or not. And beyond that, I need to trust these other creative people in a field that's not mine to do a good job. And if I get a funny feeling, if I'm not, you know, if I'm not so convinced, you know, then you say no. And with Anthony Minghella, with the movie, I knew very quickly that that whether I thought he ended up making a perfect movie or whatever, that he was going to give it a go that I was going to respect. And it's been the same with the opera. A conversation with Jennifer Higdon and a conversation with Gene Shear, the librettist, and I felt like this, my characters, my material, will be in the hands of people who have every intention of doing something wonderful with it. And what else can you ask?
Were you an opera fan, or have you been an opera fan in the past?
But no, I have not been a huge opera fan or goer or anything like that. And I think it's been part of what's been so interesting about this process. It's been going on for over 4 years. I mean, actually probably over 5 years at this point. Is watching people at, you know, at the top of their form, working in an area, I don't know, but dealing with the same narrative problems, the same characters, all of that that I worked with. I just think of it as, in a lot of ways, I think of it as the people who've written Cold Mountain. Anthony wrote his version. Gene and Jennifer have done their version. I don't have such a proprietary feel toward it. I don't want to get in there and say, oh, this should be all different in an opera or a movie. We've had long conversations over the years, and same with Anthony Minghella. We met many, many times and talked and hung out and went for hikes in the mountains and all of that. We argued about stuff. We were like two old graduate students talking about a book they'd been reading. Jennifer's music is so powerful. The beautiful bits are really beautiful, and there are pieces that are jarring and strong, and it's impossible to sit there watching it and not be affected by it. And one of the things that I have really loved about opera, you know, we're so used to music being filtered through electricity, and whatever diminishments and distortions and changes that electrical reproduction does to music, to sit with 1,500, 2,000 people listening to acoustic instruments and real unamplified human voices singing so beautifully and strongly is just an amazing experience in itself. I remember asking one of the singers this summer in Santa Fe about that ability to project over, and the opera house in Santa Fe is partially, you know, opens to the outdoors, and to be able to fill that with a voice, and she just laughed. She said, oh, it's just all physics.
Yeah.
I thought, I think there's a little more.
Will you tell me what you're working on now?
I've got a book going, and I hope I'm at least halfway through with it. That's based on the life of Verena Davis, who was Jefferson Davis's wife. And I'm not interested in Jefferson Davis, but I am interested in her. It was a really smart, well-educated Southern woman who married the guy who became president of the Confederacy. I'm interested in the in the damages of making the choices she made in life, of surviving the war and those and the devastation of it to their finances for one thing, to his ideology, which met its just end, and just the shape of a life that that began with this bright, tall, dark-skinned woman in the Deep South, and ended in New York City. After his death, she moved to New York and made part of her living writing for newspapers. She and she and General Grant's wife became friends and would go on carriage rides in Central Park.
That's amazing.
They made the news every time they had lunch together or went for a carriage ride. It would appear in the papers.
How did you decide to choose her? What piqued your interest, or what did you discover? You just were reading and.
Yeah, I think maybe the first couple of things I read about her had to do with a tutor she had who had moved south. He was educated, I think, at Princeton, and just moved in with her family, and she was his only student for over 10 years. And I thought, well, that's interesting that this woman... you know, she didn't look like a Southern belle. She was tall. She had olive-colored skin at a time when pale blondes were the ideal. When she got to Richmond, the ladies there, questioned and spread rumors about her race, and she was very very defiant about that when she was in her 60s and people criticized her from in the South, criticized her from moving to New York. She said, "I'm free, brown, and 64. I can live where I please."
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.